This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and let's jump right into our week in review. Special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation is over, and President Donald Trump is celebrating.
The special counsel completed its report and found no collusion and no obstruction.
Now, remember, we haven't seen the full 300-page report, but instead a 4-page summary written by Attorney General William Barr. And in it, Barr says the investigation concluded that Trump did not collude with the Russians, but he does suggest there is evidence of collusion, just not enough to indict. Democrats say they cannot rely on Barr's summary, and they want the full report.
You shouldn't write a book report from the Cliff Notes, and Congress should not make any final determinations from this summary given to us of the full Mueller report.
And others, like Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld, say the Democrats and the media should give it all a rest.
Democrats are definitely going to be against Trump no matter what, but there's a lot of people in the middle ground in this country who are kind of sick of this whole collusion thing, and they want to move on from it. And I think it would be wise for Democrats to heed that advice.
So let's talk about it a little bit more with Marie St. Flour. She's a former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Flour Communications. Hello, good to see you.
Wonderful to hear, Jamie.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis. He's executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Hey, Jim.
Good to be with you.
So, okay. Did you guys look at the summary of the report? What do you think? Is he exonerated? No collusion? Marie?
I mean, honestly, I don't know. I don't know because, again, we have someone who's reviewed it and gave their opinion, because that's what this is, right? I don't care who it is that would have given a summary of it. We would have all been in the same place. And so I think that the correct course of action is to release the entire report. Let us, we're grown-ups, and let us review it and come to our own conclusions rather than trying to spoon-feed us or provide us a narrative.
Even if, you know, William Barr does quote directly from it. The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities.
But I think there's more going on here, and we don't know, right? I mean, so I appreciate that he has come to some conclusion that there's no collusion. But the reality is we know that something went on that impacted our politics. We know it because over a dozen people have been indicted. And some of them have been convicted. And so the question then is, shouldn't the American people have a full breath of what it is that took place? We paid for it for over 2 years mm-hmm. with our tax dollars, and we have the right to review it. And I think that's the only thing that is going to not necessarily bring closure. Listen, the investigation that was done by Starr, many people are still fighting over it, mm-hmm. right? So you're never going to get complete closure, but at least the transparency test will have been realized.
Well, Jim Sturgis, you know, to that point of Americans wanting to see the report, a new poll from NPR, PBS NewsHour, Marist, they need a few more sponsors for that, say that 3/4 of Americans want the report to be public. Do you agree?
Who are the 25% that don't? I mean, this will be a doorstopper. They say a minimum of 300 pages. Some people say it could be as high as 900 pages. Mm-hmm. Look, this is certainly not over. I think I would say it would strain credulity for me to think that there is evidence of collusion in the report if it was so directly stated. On the obstruction of justice, I think there will still be a free-for-all, and you still have the New York Southern District Court mm-hmm. that has a lot of work underway. And Marie was very kind. She said 12 people indicted. It's actually 34, none of whom can be directly tied to the collusion narrative.
Right, but who depends on how you count all of
right,
these
but were
cases.
Who were involved in changing potentially the platform of the party as regards the Ukraine and all kinds of other things like that. I think if we've had season one, season two of this reality TV show, we should rest assured that season three is coming.
It's been renewed for another 18 seasons. Well, no, I'm glad you brought up obstruction because we spoke with Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and she's WBUR's legal analyst. And she says that obstruction is the still open question.
Barr concluded if there was no conspiracy with respect to the election, there couldn't be an obstruction of justice charge. And that's wrong. One can obstruct justice, whether or not one is in fact guilty of the crime you're obstructing the investigation to prevent.
So do you think this is still an open question, Marie?
Well, I think it's an open question for many people in this country. And I think that even Mueller's report seems to suggest that it's an open question. It wasn't for him to determine, and he truly believes that that is something that should be further investigated and the courts look into. And I think that's the appropriate course. I think people were looking for Mueller to come to a conclusion, and I don't think he felt that that was his role. I think he felt his role was to expose the facts, lay it out, and for those who need to make those conclusions, whether it be from the political sector or from the legal sector, to come to those conclusions. And that is what has to happen now. And so, yeah, there's still more work to be done. I just think that a lot of folks got ahead of themselves on both sides. Mm-hmm. And we lost sight of other things happening in this country. And we just became one big National Enquirer activity.
reality shows, Jim calls it.
Call it reality TV, but whatever. But and I think we need to sort of, both sides need to calm down, because this is really serious. It is really about who we are as a country. How do we move forward in our politics and our electoral politics particularly? And I think that this sort of cyber attack or this side of sort of attempt, it's not the first time, but it apparently is the first time that it's been so successful. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that a foreign party has been so successful in infiltrating our politics, our electoral politics, if we want to continue to protect our democracy, then we need to get down to figure out what actually happened here. And I think everybody who's heightened this up to this, Democrat, Republican, both sides need to calm down and really focus on what this is all about right now, which is truly about our country and how we move forward with our electoral politics, given the fact that there's lack of trust in so many ways about the way that our electoral politics are executed.
But if you try to look at it from both sides, on the one hand, you know, you have a president who's celebrating, who says, you know, he's exonerated, and because he was publicly charged of things that are quite dramatic. And on the flip side, you have, Democrats saying that this is terrible. So I understand the want to want to maybe tamp it all down and relax. Mm-hmm. But these are serious things we're talking about here. Right, Jim?
Well, you know, I guess, Marie, it was an incredible state legislator, and I mean that sincerely. You did incredible work on so many issues, took it so seriously. I guess I'm a more skeptical person, and I agree with what Marie said about this is about who we are as a country, but mm-hmm. I would remind all of us that we have a president that we elected, and it's certain that he had people like to use the word grifters these days. He had a bunch of grifters around him. I think anybody who is objective about this would also realize that within the FBI— there were a lot of grifters hanging around there. Mm-hmm. And the media did not actually shine in this entire process, having grifters of their own. And I know it's a big statement, but if you're taking information from Michael Avenatti, I'm sorry. We're in a bad place. And the level of trust that you mentioned before, even if you take a look at the media, look, Trump overstates it every day of the week, saying, you're worse than Congress. I was looking at it this morning just before coming in, and it's between 16% and 25%. That's below large corporations.
Approval,
Jamie.
You mean?
Approval, yeah. Trust, level of trust in the media. And we've broken a lot of things here, and a lot of people to blame for that.
Well, so how do we fix that? Because, you know, we talked to Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld this week, and he says the Democrats and the media just need to let this go because it's going to be a problem for them into the next election. Let's just listen to a quick clip, and then we'll get to you, Marie, after this.
For President Trump, it obviously gives him a huge opportunity in the next election to go around the country and say, I was falsely accused, gin up his supporters, and make the Democrats look bad.
So you were shaking your head there, Marie.
I guess this is where I sort of part ways with this whole partisan approach to all of this. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I mean, I think some folks who are statesmen or stateswomen need to sort of elevate this issue to where it needs to be. And I think great journalists and strong journalists need to actually take a step back and actually think about this from a critical perspective about who we are and where we're going. And that is what's disconcerting to me, because the lack of trust that you're talking about is in every aspect of American institution today. So it's not just politics. And that actually is really what we should be concerned about if we want to protect and elevate this democracy of ours. The world is watching us. We are supposed to be the oldest democracy, and we are supposed to be an example of how this is supposed to be done. And I would say that you know, some parts of the world would look at us and say, well, you're not any different than how I've been operating. So what right do you have to try to tell me that democracy is the right way to go? We have an opportunity for the next to reset the table for the next generation about who we are, how we operate, bring back integrity into our system, understand there is such thing as truth and untruth, and elevate that, make certain that the issue of character comes back, because we all of those things that we were all told were good things have now been sort of, you know, we're, kids must be looking at us and saying, who are you? And what do you stand for? And because the highest institutions in our country have demonstrated that we have lost those values. And that is why it's so important that we get back to the table, figure out what just happened here, not simply about going after Trump or not going after Trump, because Trump is a symptom. All right. And because none of this could have happened if we did not have the capacity already embedded in our in us to produce this kind of outcome that we have right now, where we don't know truth from false.
So that
is where we are today.
So how do we repair that trust in the institutions then, Jim? And, or Murray, you go.
I just want to go back to the issue of transparency. I still believe that there are some very good people out there who still believe in what we are about and who want to take a look at the facts as they presented and then give them an opportunity. They don't always have the mic, but give them opportunity to provide sane analysis and perhaps provide some sane conclusion. Barr was never going to be, an unbiased provider of information. He told you who he was before he was even appointed. And so he told you what his position was before he was even appointed. That sort of kicked him from, as far as I'm concerned, I am not surprised about the outcome. What I'm sad about is that our entire media apparatus has been trapped by this conversation in a loop, and there's been no real questioning mm-hmm. of both sides. I think you have to question I'm a Democrat, but you have to question Democrats and you have to question Republicans. You have to all of us have to be questioned in this work that is supposed to be about our country. It's not partisan. It's about the country, and let's get back to that.
Last word on this before we move to the next topic, Jim.
I think the separation of powers sets us free. I think that the separation of legislative, executive, and judicial power, as well as the federal, state, local, keeps people who are really ambitious, want to do really bad things, from being able to do that, and gives us an opportunity to make things public, and making it public, and I think courageously looking at every inch of what just happened would be good for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about the separation of federal and local, let's talk about Suffolk District Attorney Rachel Rawlins, because she's making an effort here to make good on some of her campaign promises. She put out a policy memo this week, and she outlined her vision for progressive prosecution, saying she wants members of her staff to inform her if they see immigration agents in the courts where they are working.
A lot of the cases that we have depend on victims and witnesses being willing to cooperate with us, and that includes immigrants. And if there's a fear of arrest or deportation that drives them away, we lose their help and we lose our cases.
And she also says that her office will dismiss low-level nonviolent offenses or resolve them without jail time.
I don't believe that people should be branded for the rest of their lives based on these low-level, non-serious crimes that often are the result of mental illness, substance use disorder, and poverty.
But Governor Charlie Baker worries that these policies won't do enough to protect the victims of crime.
Victims are owed a criminal justice system that takes their interests and their issues as seriously as everybody else's.
So let's start with the policy on immigration and customs enforcement, ICE officers in courtrooms. Jim, what do you make of that new policy?
Look, I think you've got competing interests here. You want to make sure that witnesses show up. You want to make sure that they feel like they're not going to be carted off. And to do that, she's making her case that ICE should be notifying her. You know, it's interesting. In interviews, she's mentioned that the regional head of ICE notifies every other chief of police but doesn't notify her. So
that
seems to be
Todd Lyons.
Yeah, Todd Lyons. It seems to be something, this competing interest. On the other side, there's a spat. And two grown-ups have to actually sit in a room and figure out the spat, because this is not a good situation for folks. And I mean, there are lots of reasons why I see what Governor Baker's seeing, but also you want to make sure that as DA, look, DA Rollins is a very serious person. She herself, in talking about this, says that, look, people have a right to be nervous about what I'm doing. She's trying some new things. I think she's open to listening. She's open to reach. She'll talk to anybody about this stuff. And I think we have to track it really closely as she tries to implement it. But the other part of it, these two grown-ups, the head of ICE and the DA, need to sit down in a room and figure it out.
They're welcome here on Radio Boston any day. Marie St. Flour.
I agree with that analysis. I think that what she's asked is her staff to inform her. Since the ICE has not elected to inform her, as she's indicated, they've informed everyone else in terms of the chief of police. She is a law enforcement officer. She has staff that is operating in those courtrooms that are directly impacted by the actions of ICE. I think that as a matter of course, of professional courtesy and respect, it would seem to me obvious if you're going to call one law enforcement officer, you'd also call the other. So since that is not occurring, she has asked that her staff inform her when they show up. I think that is a fair ask for an executive to ask of their staff. I don't think that's a problem.
So in a statement to multiple news outlets, Todd Lyons, as we mentioned, the acting field office director for ICE here in Boston, said that attempts to promote an overall fear or suspicion of law enforcement officers is counterproductive and very misguided. And I'm just wondering, at the same time, isn't it the DA's job to prosecute and investigate crimes with law enforcement? So again, sitting down and working with ICE, getting together, isn't that kind of part of her job?
It is, but I think it goes both ways. Look, this is not a place where, you know, the feds get to just jump in and say, we define all the terms of the debate. That's not how it works. This is a separated hierarchy of power. And so I think if he's saying don't besmirch us, don't say we're trying to do something bad, don't put fear into people's heads, he has to sit down with her and work this stuff out as well. It goes both ways.
So let's talk about her now codified do not prosecute list. She says it's part of her vision for progressive prosecution, as we mentioned. It includes things like drug offenses, shoplifting, destruction of property, and she says it's about keeping people out of the criminal justice system in the first place. This is,
I want these people out of the criminal justice system so they can get the help that they actually need, because we're the catch basin at the end of many, many societal failures in these individuals' lives.
But Governor Baker, as we heard at the top there, has concerns about this vision of progressive prosecution. Marie, what do you make of this?
Well, it's so interesting how we have criminalized a number of things that probably 30, 40 years ago we would not have criminalized. And as a result of that criminalization, we have actually embedded some real structural disparities and who's impacted and who's not impacted. And so some of the things that I saw, drug offenses, well, today we're saying don't prosecute folks who are opioid addicted. Why is that? We've had people who've been addicted for decades. But today, the complexion and the income status of many of the folks who are addicted is changing. And so now we can connect with those folks. And we say, well, these are human beings. They need to be assisted. They need to be supported. We need to figure out how we provide some sort of support for them. But before that, I mean, we had kids who were dying in Boston, whether it was in South Boston and Roxbury, for decades, of all sorts of overdose, whether it's heroin, what have you. But we were locking those kids up. When we lock those kids up, it's not simply that individual. You have turned their lives upside down.
Are you saying we were locking them up because they were black and brown kids?
We were locking them up. It's income, and it's also black and brown. I would suggest that if we look at how things have happened, overwhelmingly, it has been black and brown, but it's also has been an impact. The disparity has also occurred because of income. Because if I could afford it, my parents would be able to send me into treatment. And if for those who couldn't afford it, in many instances, Suffolk County House of Correction was the treatment that they were going to get. And that's the unfairness of that. And I think for her to challenge that system is absolutely correct, because we made those things a criminal act. And if there are alternative ways of being able to make certain that that person is rehabilitated rather than locking them up, giving them a record that they can never sometimes overcome. Mm-hmm. It impacts their ability to go to school. It impacts their ability to get a job, which means that we've shut them out of the opportunity for economic success in this state and in this country. So if there are alternative ways, we should be exploring it, because we should really be about rehabilitation and not simply about figuring out ways to lock people up more.
But Jim, how do you balance what Governor Baker mentioned, which is protecting the victims of some of these crimes, shoplifting, breaking and entering, malicious destruction of property?
No, it's, look, just on what Marie was saying, she's absolutely right. We go through cycles. This is what we do in law enforcement thinking and in any kind of policy thinking. So I guess here's what I'd say to that, Jamie. D.A. Rollins is trying to do something really hard, which may not actually even make logical sense. And I respect her a ton, but let me put it this way. She has a 65-page memo that's trying to codify discretion. The word discretion means good judgment in a particular situation. When you codify it, you make a general rule. When you make a general rule, you're essentially regulating it. And once you do that, you change how people perceive the action they might undertake. So there is a worry about this. And I think, look, I would take it a little more slowly and test things out, watch the empirical data, see how it works. I would not go wholesale into all 15 decriminalized actions that she has done. I would wish that she would rethink some of this. But look, the pendulum does swing the other way when people kind of say, hey, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 70s.
She's taking a claim far out, maybe.
Broken windows, that may not have worked altogether well. And, you know, criminalizing people to the place where we've actually gone into mass incarceration, that may not be working very well. Mm-hmm. I get that.
Got it. So, man, we didn't even get to rent control or all the other things we wanted to talk about in Week in Review. But I do want to get to our hubbubs, those little stories or events that caught her attention. I know.
I'm bad with this hubbub business.
It's a turn. Do you have one, Marie?
No? One.
All right. Marie's taking a mulligan on the hubbub. Okay. Well, Jim, what's your hubbub?
I'll do one in honor of D.A. Rollins in her memo. So, and Mark Twain would have loved this. It's coming from Elmira, New York, a center of Twain studies. A middle-aged man stole a Little Debbie Cakes delivery truck while it was being loaded with product. We are talking banana marshmallow cream pies. We're talking fudged dipped strawberry cakes, cookies and cream cakes, fudge dipped banana rolls, red velvet cakes, pecan, spin wheels, zebra cake, oatmeal cream pie. He stole the vehicle, he said, because he had to go visit his family. Now, get this. He did not eat any of the cakes. Number two, his family didn't get any of the cakes. He's either very honest or he's very cheap.
And D.A. Rollins wouldn't lock him.
That's not lock him.
So my hubbub really quickly here is about a conversation that we had on the show yesterday with Eileen McNamara about proposed cuts to the Special Olympics and the Department of Education budget. Now, McNamara is an expert on Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She's the Kennedy sister who founded the Special Olympics. And so here's what McNamara told us at the beginning of our show yesterday.
Her spirit is hanging over the Capitol right this moment, and it is enraged. You do not want to be in the path of Eunice Kennedy Shriver when she was enraged.
So apparently she was enraged yesterday because just about an hour after McNamara told us that, President Trump said this on the White House lawn.
I've been to the Special Olympics. I think it's incredible. And I just authorized a funding. I heard about it this morning. I have overridden my people. We're funding the Special Olympics.
So I'm not saying it was a ghost, but maybe.
So ask Market Basket.
Yeah. There's a story this week of a ghost at Market Basket. There's your hubbub, Marie. Well, that's Marie St. Flour. She's a former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Flour Communications. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.